Today's episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
So contrary to what you might be thinking right now, our subject today is not Kanye West. It is Ray Bradbury. We're going to start talking about Ray Bradbury.
He's the Kanye West.
He's the Kanye West of his
time. Pioneer, really.
Ray Bradbury has such a wide library of things that he's written that we cannot, in good conscience, talk about everything that Ray Bradbury has done. So we're going to focus our discussion today on one of his short stories out of his book, The Illustrated Man. Before we jump into that, I want to give a little background about Ray Bradbury. He was born August 22nd, 1920, and he died June 5th, 2012.
Yep.
That was really recent. Yeah, yeah.
I remember it when that happened. Yeah, like, I remember being like, oh, and it was the beginning of the end of people just, like, starting to die. Remember? Of death came after the apocalypse of 2012.
Knows. Yeah.
That's what kicked it
stretch
off, actually.
Of death.
It is. Yeah. Culminated with Betty White.
Yep.
And,
You just reminded me.
Pour one out. Bring it down the room.
Bradbury was a prolific writer of sci-fi and horror. He often found these two genres blended well together, I feel like. His idea of the future was not utopian, I don't think. His idea in a lot of his stories was very anti-utopian, and technology was not the savior that it's presented at. And that made him kind of
It's very
unique.
Contrarian for a sci-fi writer, right?
Because especially at that time, so many of them were utopian.
Yep. Right. Yes.
They
exactly.
all said we could be better people than we are. And I feel like he was consistently like, nope, we'll be the same people, just in different contexts.
Exactly.
Yeah. When it comes to his speculative fiction, I think you're right. He very much projects a humanity that never matures, never really evolves beyond who we are now. Which is interesting because some of his other, peers that he's writing alongside felt very differently.
Yeah.
Arthur C. Clarke
believed
is like
in
the
us.
Complete opposite end of that spectrum. Yeah. Keep going.
All right. Cool.
I think, I was going to say or the other foot, he's got a short story. It's in Illustrated Man. That one's kind of optimistic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he wasn't without optimism in some of his stuff, but I feel like, there was a lot to say. A lot of cautionary tales with that too. So, something I found very interesting was that he was influenced by H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, but he was also influenced by poets and by just a wide variety of literary references, such as Alexander Pope and John Donne. And this got me thinking when you and I, Trevor, we both read Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Right.
And we talked about the difficulty of the prose, how it's not something that easily lets you into the story. You have to work through it. And it had a very lyrical kind of sound to it, rhythm to it.
Prose. Even a lot of his prose really leans very heavily on kind of sensory information, which I think is also very poetic by its nature. Right?
I can see how poetry influenced him when I think about things like that.
Absolutely.
So what we're going to talk about today, though, is the short story The Veldt, which came, am I saying that right? The Veldt?
The Veldt.
Which came out of his novel story collection.
It's not really a story collection.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting what Bradbury does, because a lot of his books are actually not really necessarily novels. I mean, Something Wicked This Way Comes is a novel.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit 451 is definitely a novel.
Right.
But you look at like the Martian Chronicles, all of those stories, all of those little vignettes that make up the story arc of that novel were actually published serially in other places. And they were actually written over a much longer period of time. So a lot of the stories in The Illustrated Man even were published prior in like magazines somewhere.
Including The Veldt.
And then were republished and kind of like reconstituted through this framing device of the
Illustrated Man. That's what makes these collections different than like your standard short story collection from an author, is that these are framed to where they're all taking part in the same universe almost.
They are, and they're tied back. I mean, same thing to Something Wicked This Way Comes, right? Because The Illustrated Man is a character in that. But I think it's just the through line. It's the lens that lets us see these short stories as a compilation instead of being disparate.
Yeah, action. I mean, he really, I think he gives these stories a greater sense of cohesion through that, right? Because they're all told on the same canvas and we're given the same framing device. Yes, right. Yeah. The human body is a canvas. I think it elevates a lot of these stories and forces us as readers, I think, to try to figure out the through line. What is the connective tissue from all of these different disparate stories that give us a much broader perspective of what his philosophy was? I mean, kind of like you were suggesting.
Yeah, I'm talking about a deep dive here. I mean, I'm seeing not only the connective tissue of this and of his works, but immediately my mind goes to like Clive Barker and his Books of Blood and how this influenced. I can see the influence of the Illustrated Man on Barker's work as well too.
Yeah. Well, and I think so often as writers, there are a lot of writers who will become like seized by an idea, right? And it shows up repeatedly, you know, kind of a motif in a lot of their writing as they explore issues, philosophical issues that are really important to them.
Right.
And I think Bradbury is one of those who continues to come back to these same ideas, these same issues pertaining to human life and human existence.
So who wants to tell what the, like, give a brief summary of what the Veldt's about?
Great question.
Yeah. I just read it on my phone.
Okay, there you go, there you go.
So you want me to read it?
Sure.
I'm just playing. If you know, I would rather somebody just,
I will. Yeah, it's it's a story about this family that lives in what's effectively a smart home that takes good care of them, and the nursery is this very fantastical room that has these crystalline walls that project any image, and it's very sensory, sensory intensive, and these parents have realized that there's something wrong with their nursery. Every time they walk in there, it's an African veldt, and it is just this big, like, expanse of plain, and there are these lions. And so they're trying to figure out what's going on with their children, because the veldt, I mean, the nursery just reflects what their kids' internal dialogue looks like, what their imagination sees. And so the parents are trying to figure that out, and as that goes, you know, the story kind of just
First thought when I read this was, like, that Star Trek: The Next Generation, like the holodeck or whatever.
Yeah, the holodeck.
Yeah,
it's very much the
it's the virtual reality.
Room. Yeah, yeah. The room is virtual reality. It's a holodeck. Yeah. I think that it's not for him, like, you know, the hard light or whatever it is that the holodeck is. But
yeah,
I was also really reminded of the Disney film. What was it? Was it Smart House?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Smart House.
It was,
it was like a Disney Channel original, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah. I remember that.
And it has, what's her name? Like, the actual, like, bona fide actress is the house. What's her name?
Oh, the lady who was
from Sons of Anarchist, and the wife from
Married with Children.
Married with Children,
And she's Leela on Futurama.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I'm drawing a total blank on her name.
The most Kate famous something? Person
Katie
that
Seagal.
You can't.
Katie Seagal.
There
yes.
it is.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I was about to say Peg Bundy, but that's that doesn't.
But yes, yeah.
And that one, the house turns all needy and jealous, right?
Like, but does,
like,
I mean,
like, don't leave me.
Locks them in. I mean, it's not totally different.
That cracks me up. That cracks me up. By the way, the Disney Channel original.
Yeah,
and we're obviously citing the source where Disney Channel got this.
Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I was like, I want all that shit. I want orange juice on a conveyor belt. Yeah,
That is the idea.
I just wanted the Pee Wee Herman house, where, like, the what do you even call it? The little machines.
It's
or whatever.
Made of nightmares.
Oh, dude, Lawrence Fishburne comes over with a cowboy outfit on. No way.
That's still what Lawrence Fishburne and the cowboy hat?
Nightmares are made of.
Cherry!
It's too creepy.
Reining this back in.
Yeah, but yeah, the thought of virtual reality in the 1950s, it's interesting that anybody thought about virtual reality back then.
Well, I think this is one of Bradbury's kind of mainstay preoccupations. In a lot of his work, he's constantly looking at, like, the relationship between humankind and technology.
Right.
And I think that, in a way, you know, we talk about him being influenced by Jules Verne or H.G. Wells. I mean, H.G. Wells covered a lot of this idea of, like, the impact of technology on human beings and how this technology can kind of shape human futures. He tackled that in The Time Machine really well, right? Mm-hmm. Wherein we have human beings who become so reliant on technology to do all of the things they need for them, that they kind of very complacently become the food of the Morlocks that, like, you know, like, live underground and, you know, creep up and eat the Eloi, right?
We're by no means, we're by no means heading in that direction.
Yeah, this is, no, we're there. Well, we're there.
Let's be real. H.G. Wells was absolutely, like, a straight-up communist, right? Like, no, like...
Are you
like,
saying that's Bradbury's message, too, in this story, then?
I do. I think that what Bradbury does is he looks at a lot of technology and he says that, you know, he was very, I think, preoccupied with the space that technology continued to occupy in our lives.
Yeah, and this was 1950.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, you read something like Fahrenheit 451, that is constantly misremembered. That book is not about the censorship of books or media at all. It's about the loss of intellectual curiosity. It's about the loss of I think, critical thinking that is done when we allow media to govern our tastes. Yep. We allow media to invade our lives so much that we are more preoccupied.
Yeah. So when we hand over that agency, right? Like, we're like, you know what? This is fine. You can tell me what it is that I like. And then... that's easy enough.
And I'll like it.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, that's, I mean,
and
that's,
that'll be my whole personality.
And some of it is, it's a respect thing, right? Like, you, if you respect the media, then you respect what the media has to offer you. Or like, if you respect your friend's older brother, then you only listen to what he listens to. Right. Like, that's how you decide your taste.
So do you guys think this is kind of a callback then to, I mean, given the time that this was written, we know that like television is really becoming a part of people's lives. And the whole argument of television's going to dumb the kids down and don't let television kind of replace you as the babysitting.
But I don't necessarily know that it's about a dumbing down.
That wasn't the message.
It's a trade-off.
No.
You lose a few things and you gain a few things.
That's just that's just one of the arguments that people used to make about television, that it's going to make you dumber. But the bigger argument that to me kind of speaks more to the story is that idea of don't let television replace, you know, you're parenting with these kids. And it's almost like what happens in this book, in this
way,
story.
Right. But I also think that there's a kind of a subtext here through the entire story where he's really like just talking about the over-reliance on like the efficiency of living or having something do the laborious things for you. Because I think he's kind of circling around and saying that in human life, human labor contributes a lot to like our lives and how we conceive of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
So the danger of wish fulfillment through like a house that can do everything is an over-reliance on the creature comforts instead of understanding, you know, kind of the value of you doing things for yourself.
But I think it's so we talk about how I think what Bradbury to me understands is like the necessity of human relationships. And we talked about this, like what his futures always look like a reflection of what we are now because we don't really change. And I think part of what the story is exploring is not just that, but like where technology has stepped in and isolated people even in their relationships. So you have a husband and a wife and children, and that is like your core nuclear family, and that should be like the core relationship. But the technology has now isolated all four of them. So it's it's that each one of us, at least the parents from the kids, but I would say the parents from each other too, because at some point they're kind of like, oh, I mean, you're kind of unhappy too, and like
there's this conversation I think that the man has with his wife, right? Where they talk about like maybe we should just turn the house off, right? Maybe we need to turn this off, and he's like, you mean that like you're gonna darn my socks for me?
Uh huh.
Like you're gonna cook my food?
I love how you say darn, because that word stuck out to me too when I read it. I was like, darn my socks. Like,
darn my socks.
Has anyone had their socks darned in like a century? No.
I asked my wife if she would darn my socks the other day because I
what
have
is
holes
that?
In,
I'm gonna play
it's,
stupid.
It's repairing the Fix socks them. With like holes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's like sewing.
Yeah, it didn't. It is from a time when we did not have fast fashion, where you couldn't just go buy more socks.
See, that's what I do.
Less effort.
So when people say, darn it, them. That's what they mean. Fix my
sew
socks.
It back for me? Yeah. But he does. He's, are you going to cook my eggs, I think, is the example that's left. Like, and she's like, yes, Yes, yeah. I will, with like yeah. tears in her eyes.
They talk to the kids too about like, you know, turning off the house, and one of the kids is like, am I going to have to tie my shoes? And I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, you little shit.
So that's the dad's attitude, but it's funny because I immediately thought to myself, I was like, there's no way this kid even knows how to tie shoes. Because like, that was my first thought, was like, I'm trying to teach a four-year-old right now how to tie shoes, and I guarantee these parents did not teach this boy. He has never learned.
I was just unsettled because the kids kept calling him, like when they'd respond to him, they'd be like, yes, mother, yes, father. And I'm like, you're creepy little kid.
It's sarcasm.
Yeah, I know it's sarcasm. Yeah.
Oh, they're being sarcastic?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I think...
He didn't have a lot of dialogue tags with that. A lot of it was just straight dialogue, so you have to read into it.
In a way,
I think it was sarcasm, but it was...
The kids kind of are the villains of the story.
Okay.
Oh, they're horrible.
No, yeah. The kids... So there is... the kids are named Peter and Wendy, right? This is obviously an allusion to Peter Pan.
Yeah.
But Peter Pan... is also very misremembered, in my opinion, because Peter Pan is like this fun fantasy where like kids go off to a land without adults, which obviously is what the Velt's playing at here. But Peter Pan understands that kids are like malicious, self-centered little a-holes who don't realize.
Wasn't there also a fairy orgy in that?
Right.
Yeah, but like the point is like violence has no... We actually talked about...
No, I'm serious. There was.
No, but we actually talked about this earlier where we were talking about how like as a kid you probably wished your parents died at some point, like you were mad and you were like, I just wish you would die, right?
Yeah,
and like you genuinely meant it but did not understand fully what it is that you were saying.
Exactly.
And children are that way, and I think that the Peter and Wendy illusion to me is very much in line with what
I mean. They're like totally forgive me, but they're totally ruled by id, right?
It's just
pure impulse,
right?
Malicious,
like
impulse.
Peter Pan,
right?
Yep. Who again gets misremembered as this like fun kind of fantastical thing, and I'm like, he almost lets her brother die, like in the early scene. George falls asleep or something.
Well, and he's just gonna let him fall. Like the Lost Boys who wanted to leave, didn't he kill
them? Yeah. They
I mean, it's a very dark.
Is it cull them? They cull them is the word that's used.
Yeah.
Cull.
That's cull.
Yeah.
No, I know, but like like cattle. Like they...
Right. Yeah. You're right.
Ugh.
But yeah,
dark shit.
Peter Pan was dark to begin with. So anyway, that was the thing that stuck out on this reading to me, was like, obviously it's that the darkness Peter within Wendy. Children.
Well, and it's obvious that Ray Bradbury is taking that darker understanding of Peter Pan, and this is not the, you know, as he's applying it to his story.
Yes.
Yeah, this is not the Disney version of Peter Pan.
Thank you, Disney, for misrepresenting yet another story.
Right?
So, I mean, maybe it's just the Marxist in me who keeps like coming back. I mean, I keep coming back to stories like this and other stories by Bradbury where he's, I mean, it seems he is really, really preoccupied with like what is lost when we allow something to do things for us, when we continue to alienate ourselves from, you know, the fruits of our labors.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the in a way, like this is kind of like the total like effect of late capitalism here,
mm-hmm.
right? Where it's like we can't conceive of our lives without the things, the machines, the whatever, you
whatever
know, kind
happens
of doing
to
it
be.
For
yeah.
us.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to our humanity, our sense of humanity, when we are so divorced from the consequences, you know, of our actions.
Right.
That very technology eats us.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Exactly.
But to the note we talked
Thank
about,
you for that, too, because I think we've got a habit of spoiling.
It's fine. You know, they actually have done studies on that, and spoiler alerts actually make people more invested in, like, having read spoilers makes you more invested in the first viewing because you're looking for those spoiler clues.
Right.
So
I'm one of those.
It becomes a second, it's like the second viewing where you're excited
I'm
about
I'm renaming
things.
The podcast Spoiler Alert.
Mm-hmm. Accidentally.
That'd be easier to say to my Alexa.
Discovered why.
I thought I was weird. I thought I was the only
Slate House Publishing presents Lit Bits Podcast.
Anyway. We've accidentally figured out why our listener numbers keep going up every week. We spoil everything.
They've prepared the statement is why they go up. It's because they've been practicing having to say it to themselves.
Yeah. Just lean into it. Just lean into the spoilers.
Spoiler alert on the technology. I think we talked about the Disney version, and I think the Disney smart house has a similar point where there is the house doesn't want to die.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
And that's the proposition that the father has given the house, and kind of with some idiocy to its face. He's like, I'm turning this thing off, like in it.
Well, even the psychologist comes back and says, you know, something that's alive doesn't want to die.
Yeah.
You were about to say that guy?
No, like, I was just saying, I mean, just as a psychologist, he's like, oh, this is very dark. I'm like,
I love it. He comes in and he looks at the room. He's like, y'all know this is fucked up, right?
Right. And then he's like, you guys.
Kids need therapy.
Yes, every day. And you two have done a terrible job. I'll be back in an hour.
That's right. He's like, they need a fucking year.
Every day. Which seems a little prescriptive. He's like, I'm going to make some bank here.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think so you talked about the lyricism of Bradbury, and I think he does do a really wonderful job with the veldt itself, and like the big thing that I took away is that the veldt is yellow, right? And I feel like that's a cautionary, like you're supposed to feel that dry caution.
Yeah.
That, like it's like it's a warning sign the whole way. Everything's yellow. Like the grass is yellow and the lions are yellow and their eyes are even yellow. Like everything is yellow. But I feel like the
jaundiced lions.
Right. But that's where the lyricism comes in. Like you're supposed to be like, oh no, this is a bad idea.
I mean, it is very evocative. Mm-hmm. Right? I think his fiction is really good at trying to circle around this sensory information and then just kind of, you know, like
feel it.
Yeah, punch it with us.
And what do we call that, kids, when the outside scene reflects the interior?
The objective correlation.
Yeah, I feel like we've heard this in the podcast a couple of times before.
Thank you.
This is season two. Still, we're not supposed to be doing this anymore.
Oh, yeah, we're not supposed to talk about the objective. It's kind of hard to get away from, though. I mean, we keep coming back to it.
I learned what that was last month, and now I want to talk about it. So I just say it to people. Like, it doesn't even make sense when I say it.
That's the objective correlative.
Oh, I can't say that either. We're grocery shopping. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, this outside reflects my inside, so I'm hungry and there's food here.
That's exactly what I said to the loan officer when I went to the bank to get the money for the swim spa. I'm like, this is my objective correlative. I want to feel like this on the outside and inside.
He's like, what?
I thought you were going to go with something about these parents' outsides or insides being on the outside.
Oh,
the
Another spoiler.
It's pretty grim.
I mean, it's a very short story, so I think we can spoil it. It's kind of hard to talk about this with any substance.
Okay, it came out 70 years ago. Like, at some point, you're like, it's fair. We
did that with Shirley Jackson.
Did this with Shirley Jackson, too.
I think there's a threshold where, like, it's no longer a spoiler. If we can talk about The Sixth Sense, we can talk about The Veldt.
We did that with The Lottery, which is, like, required reading in high school. Spoiler alert for this story that everyone's fucking reading.
Oh my goodness. Okay. I'm off.
I mean, does that kind of cover it? I think it does.
I think so. Well,
Bradbury.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. That's it. That's all there was to Bradbury.
I mean, I will say,
so like as a parent, so you mentioned that this is what we were going to discuss, and I was like, I literally think about that story all the time because I am a parent of small children right now. And I like genuinely think about the veldt. Like, day to day. And I feel like it's really interesting because, again, we talked about this being 70 years old. Like, it's a very far-reaching understanding of, like, the life that we do currently live. And, like, the whole... You see this a lot with parents not realizing what their kids are watching. Yeah. Like, even kids' content. Yeah. But, like, if you're not watching it with them, then you don't really know what it is. And I think that's exactly what's happened here, is that they've checked this box of, well, my kid's in Fairyland, or my kid's gone off to Wonderland, or my kid's doing whatever. They're fine.
Yeah.
And then discovering that, like, well, I mean, they are fine, but there's a moral responsibility, I think, to, like, make your people, your children, into functional adult people.
You can't take your eyes off. Yeah.
You can't, like, wash your hands of that responsibility. Like, you're – not to say that kids are like carpets and should be stepped on sometimes, which I thought was a very bold – it was also, like, a big dick move for a guy who has done nothing with his kids. Like, I feel like he come in like, oh, I'm going to step on these children. Like, okay, buddy, where have you been?
I'm really glad that you're chiming in on this, because I did want to ask you and Curtis, as parents – I mean, you're not parents together, but you each have your own kids.
We do. We have children.
How this resonated with you. Like,
nobody knew that.
But But I'm also... Our listeners may not have known that.
That's fair.
That's another podcast. I think we've covered all of our cliches.
Curtis and I do not share children, just for clarification. But we both have children.
We both have children.
There are offspring.
Yeah. So what is the question?
I don't remember anymore.
So what is the take? I think your question is, what is the take?
Yeah, your take on this.
Curtis, let me go.
Okay, so YouTube Kids, for instance, just got me thinking about this. Uh-huh. YouTube Kids is four kids, but YouTube has admitted, we don't know how to finagle the algorithm to where it keeps malicious content out, right? Mm-hmm. And so my kids just aren't allowed on YouTube. I've delineated it. YouTube is for grown-ups. Nick Jr. is for kids. Like, those are the hard delineations. But then she goes and hangs out with her cousin, and he's allowed to watch YouTube Kids.
Right.
So I'm out in the hot tub with the grown-ups, and the kids are inside, and I'm sitting there biting my nails the whole time, like, what is that little shit showing my daughter?
Right. And well, and also, like... I'm not going to speak to your daughter's cousin. I'm sure he's a wonderful little boy. But, like, there is, I think there's a real fear too, like, for me, I grew up as a child, like, when chat room sort of hit. Like, I was probably 10, 11, 12 when chat rooming became a thing.
Yeah.
And so, like,
same here.
As an adult, I now have a totally different, like, I'm like, oh, very dangerous, right?
Very dangerous.
And so, like, I feel like I've come around almost full circle around exactly that. But you do run into the issue of it's not just your control. Like, you can say, we can't watch YouTube here, or, like, we don't want, even parents who are real anti-Disney film or whatever, if you're anti-anything, and you're like, you're not allowed to watch that, well, but then they go to school, and at school, they do, like, movie day, and it's like, they're watching some movie that you didn't clear, which, understandably, because also, if you've ever hung out with four-year-olds, especially 20 of them, at some point, you're like, we're putting on a movie, because I need all of you guys to just do something
chill
else.
Out. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And so, there's very little control over the content your children encounter, even when you try to put controls in place.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, so to that point, especially because the addictive nature of social media, addictive nature of entertainment now, like, entertainment is built to be addictive.
Yeah.
You play to that, like, kids are all id. And so if you give them something that is designed to attract them, designed to make them want to come back to it, they're not going to say no. And I think that's exactly what's happened in the Veldt. They've built this world, and it is theirs. And this nursery has loved them and coddled them and rocked them as children. And that's where their relationship lies, is with the nursery.
Right. They've got no outside context.
They don't care for their parents.
Yeah.
And I love the moment. I've got the page open because I've been thinking about it stuck out my head when I read this, and I just wanted to, like, keep coming back to it. But they mentioned throughout the story, like, the different screams they sometimes hear, and they have to rush to the thing.
Yeah.
And the last scene where we have the parents,
their screams.
Yeah, it says
horrifying.
Mr. and Mrs. Hadley screamed, and suddenly they realized why those other screams had sounded familiar.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And we go to this idea of Peter Pan of like the, you know, the kids and they're playing in their id. And I mean, this is not something that's happening in this one house. This is something he's saying is happening everywhere, I think.
Oh, is that? I read it as if the kids have been fantasizing about their parents' death.
About their parents being murdered by lions for
a long time. That's how I took it.
Yeah, maybe.
I took it to mean that. But I also...
Because there's all of those like allusions to the parents are never quite able to see what it is that the lions are eating, Bradbury continues to see that through, and I think
a whole communal takeover of, like, the AI.
No, because he finds his chewed up wallet in there, and his wife's scarf is in there.
Yeah.
I appreciated too that Bradbury takes this, and he does this pretty consistently, where he takes sci-fi into almost like magic realism, slow slides into that, because like with the wallet and the with the lions. I'm sorry, let me go back to the original, like how something that is supposed to be a figment of their children's imagination has now breached a crystalline wall and become a tangible thing. So there's like almost this like mythological like tulpa aspect here that the kids have focused on it so hard that it's become reality.
Yeah.
I think the Poltergeist needs to be brought up a little bit too.
Yeah.
Because she gets sucked into the TV, you know, and this movie's made in the 80s by a generation of people that lived without television.
Right.
And so they're really fresh on the fears of what TV media, television is doing. So, when the two worlds connect with one another, that's like where the horror really kicks into high gear.
Well, he plays with that idea early on in the story too, because the parents hear something and they run to the room, and then the lions start chasing after them, and they panic, and they, you know, they run out of the room, and then the wife is like crying.
The door.
And the door like thuds, and the husband just starts laughing, and he's like, oh, it's just AI. It's just, you know, there's no way they could be coming after us.
It's just a VR thing.
It's supposed to be a kind of virtual reality experience.
Right. Right.
They're not supposed to be able to escape the walls, which I think it tells a story of a boundary has been crossed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? And you can't uncross that boundary. And
thinned.
And it's entirely supernatural. Exactly. There's no way that could materialize. So,
well,
I mean, by the rules of what he kind of tells us is this room, it should not be possible.
Right.
Yeah. It shouldn't.
The fear is that it has become possible, right?
Yeah.
It should not be possible that these kids have designs to murder their parents, and yet they've already done it. They've already made
over
the design.
Over and over and over.
Right. To the point of obsession.
Yes. Right. They have been obsessed with
murdering
their parents.
Kind of a Twilight Zone feel about it.
Definitely
it?
A Twilight Zone feel.
And I'm about to get real philosophical, so I apologize. But like, there's a degree, you hear it a lot, right? People being like, manifest your dream reality, like manifest your destiny. And I've been kind of on this rabbit hole of like how older cultures believed in different things and how you like see similarities across cultures that have been sort of distilled into this fantasy notion now that we're like, oh, you know, like there weren't dragons. They just, you know, these six disparate cultures all had something that they thought was a dragon, you know, whatever.
Right.
But like I write like fantasy, and it's got like magic realism elements. And one of the things that I've come across is people discussing like shapeshifting and cultures that have shapeshifter elements. Mm-hmm. And the kind of logic behind it is more along the lines of like, say you're in a room and the radio is playing. This is how I had it explained to me. The radio is playing and it's playing a country station. And like, as far as you are concerned, that country station is the only station that exists at the moment that it's playing.
Right.
But like, all of the radio waves for all of those stations are in the room with you. You're just not tuned into them.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the idea of these like different superstitions, is that like all of these realities kind of exist and we're just tuned into the one that we think is true based on how we've been conditioned. And so I think the Veldt does that. The Veldt crosses that line to say that like, here's the rules that you were given, but those may not be real rules.
Right. Some kind of quantum leap happened in reality.
It's not a fantasy Veldt. It is a tie to an actual Veldt. There are real lions somewhere, or like, I don't know, your children are the lions. Who knows? Right. Like, I, anyway.
Yeah. I think you're onto something there. I look at this story and I think a lot about like, just the psychology of children and maybe what
they're
Bradbury
incredible.
Is trying to say about like how our perceptions are shaped by what we kind of put into our lives. You know, I think he's really making an argument here for like the nurture element of that great debate of like, is it nature versus nurture?
Right. Yeah.
And he's kind of suggesting like what you become, what you get, the world around you is eventually
lions.
You know, kind of.
Yeah.
Is it nature versus nurture? No, it's lions.
I think it's shaped by what you kind of focus on. It's shaped by like the media that you ingest, and then what you fixate on, right? And so he seems to be saying like have we crossed over this barrier yet? Have we crossed this boundary where there is, you know, kind of this point of no return? Have we fixated so much on whether it be the technological aspects or, you know, the ways in which these new technologies can kind of like let us play out these fantasies?
Yes.
Have we crossed over this this ridge where we no longer recognize ourselves. And you know, is that not the fear? I mean, the fear is not being able to recognize the people that are around us, or the people that we've raised, you know, through this inundation, if you will, of wish fulfillment.
Like slow and steady too. I think like we're on the slow drip now, and we see it with the Internet of Things and stuff like that. And I sound like a real conspiracy theorist. This is not actually like the way I live my life. I obviously have an Alexa. I say, Alexa, play Slay House Publishing Presents Lit Bits Podcast. I think fixation is an interesting word that you've brought up. And I think the way it ties to technology is interesting, because I think so. And part of what I think is also illustrated here is this isolation that all of the characters feel based on their like technology making life easier for them. And especially coming out of a pandemic, I know we all understand the concept of isolation, but I think isolation also breeds fixation. And like even now, you can be, everyone is accessible in a way that's like the whole world is accessible to you in a way that you can become hyper fixated on like anything you choose.
Right.
Or anyone. And so like you, like, I think it's like, it's easier to have, I had this discussion with somebody the other day, because like I said, the prequel I'm working on has an affair in it. And it's like one of those things where it's like, it's easier to have like an emotional affair now, I think, than a physical affair, because physical affairs, like somebody's always watching, right? But you can have an emotional affair, and you can have a fixation on another person who doesn't even know you exist in a way that didn't used to be. And so I feel like, anyway, all that to say, what's happened here is that isolation has left these parents completely isolated from their children and each other, and they're now like trying to scramble.
Yeah,
and it's too late. Like the therapist said.
As somebody, I mean, as somebody who's older than everybody else in this room, I can tell you, like watching like the rise of Facebook, the rise of Twitter, watching people like lean themselves into their phones or their computers or their laptops or their tablets or whatever to reach out to make these connections that are so important to them on this social media, and they shut themselves off from the people around them.
I mean, I feel like that's ultimately the, maybe it's the fear that I continue to come back to. Again, it's like the Marxist in the room, right? Like the fear of alienation, right? The fear of no longer like being able to see yourself reflected in the fruits of your labor, right? The alienation that we continue to feel is most terrifying, because if how we construct our identities, how we recognize ourselves in the world, in the moment, is through the labor that we kind of put in. When we replace that with something like a media or a technology presence, when we divorce ourselves from the ability to see each other reflected in the way that we interact, right? What then is the identity that we make for ourselves?
Right. And where does the value lie? So like I had this conversation with my husband recently about social media and how like, you now go and stay in Airbnbs that are aesthetically pleasing, not because you find them aesthetically pleasing, but because you're going to take a photo in this aesthetically pleasing place and have it as a backdrop for this brand that you are cultivating.
Yeah.
And so like where does, it does become valuable. It's more valuable than just the experience. The aesthetic has become so valuable that it's like, that is the tinder like we are using, for fuel online. Like that's our
well, and then I think there's also just a maybe a divorce from like the actual real people that we are and the people that we portray ourselves to be in these other spaces. I think there's a bit of horror discourse that's kind of going on right now. Again, it's just a moment of preoccupation where we're talking about like, are artists their stuff?
Sure.
Like, is their stuff really a reflection of the inner person? And I think there's a lot of worry about, you know, who we portray ourselves to be online is not necessarily who we really are.
Sure.
We ran into this a little bit when we were talking to Omakatsu last week, where, you know, we know of her through her work, through her books, through, you know, the huge success that she's had in the last decade with her publishing career, and yet she does not perceive herself that way. She doesn't perceive herself to be.
She was really surprised to see that we saw her like that.
Award-winning author. You know, and I think that
because she's a person on the inside,
she is
exactly.
She's hanging out in her kitchen,
and I think that sometimes it's easy for us to forget the people on the other side of that avatar. I know Eric LaRocca is talking about that a lot on Twitter too. Another horror writer, where he's really preoccupied right now. I think about, you know, like there's a person on the other side of this,
right?
And the way that we interact with each other online oftentimes can become so transactional because I feel like we've been taught to see each other as these online commodities. Yeah. You know,
very much, right? Even like your like or your comment is understood both by the person leaving it and the person receiving it to be a show of display. Like it's a display of value. Yeah. It is, I am offering you this comment so that it will boost you in this algorithm, and I know that I'm doing that.
Yeah.
Like I'm playing the algorithm for you as a transactional way of showing support or whatever.
It's an actual transaction.
It's an actual transaction. Like even just engagement is a transaction
to
now.
To the benefit of Mark Zuckerberg.
It's so difficult to then, you know, find the people, I think, behind the screen, you know, to be like, I love Amakatsu's work. Yeah. And I feel like the more I learn about her as a person, the more I'm like, man, I wish I could sit in that room and talk to her for forever. And that's awesome. That that's not necessarily possible, but
she might have other things to do, but you never know. You should ask. Right. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't hurt to ask.
I mean, we did, and she showed up. What was amazing about it. But I think that, you know, I don't know. I continue to worry about when people listen to this show, you know, they listen to a version of myself that I try to be as authentic as I can on the show, but, you know, are they seeing the authentic me? Are they seeing a performance of me? What's the perception there? You know, when they interact with me on Twitter as at Slayhouse Lipids, right? Yeah. Like, are they interacting with me because they believe me to be, you know, the publishing house, or they believe me to be the podcast, or are they interacting with me because they believe me to be me in that moment?
Yeah.
And it's also really hard to, I don't know, have a Twitter presence where I'm trying to be authentic about like the things that like really genuinely hurt me or excite me or whatever. Is that not, you know,
I don't know
an
if
endorsement
anybody,
from the house? I don't know.
I don't know if anybody can be authentic, because I mean, the word person is Latin for mask.
Right.
So to be a person is to be a mask.
A series of them.
Right. Really. And so like I got rid of Facebook 7 years ago and it was a culmination of like, even when I'm talking one-on-one with somebody, who I am is getting lost in translation to a degree.
Right.
There's not a shadow of hope that's going to come off through Facebook. Just no hope at all. I was somebody on Facebook that I absolutely hated. I did not like this person that I was on Facebook or any kind of social media.
Sure.
And so, you know, to some degree, you're always playing a role. And so, you know, when I'm doing the podcast or the live stream, I'm doing a lot of talking, and then later I listen back and I'm like, do I talk too much? Did I say the right stuff? Mm-hmm. Did it sound weird when I said that? And I'm kind of the point where like none of that matters, because it's all performative anyway. Like even if I'm talking straight to my mom in the kitchen and we're the only ones there, it's still a fragmented part of who I actually am. So I kind of gave up on the chase.
It's based
for
on
authenticity. And if you just kind of relax into it and not worry about authenticity, that's as authentic as you can be. And so that's kind of where I am now.
Yeah, I think, and that, to your point, that depends on how your mom also views you, right? Because she...
Right, which I have no idea how she views me.
Right, so like everything you say is time-loaded back to the moment where she taught you how to use a spoon, right? And there's
no,
she can't divorce that from you. Like,
yes.
And I, again, now as somebody with small children, am living in that weird space where you're like straddling the future and the past, where you're like both... the child, and you're remembering this from your own childhood, but now you're seeing it through the lens of your parent, and it's a trip.
These layers get convoluted.
They do. It's back to time, just kind of immemorial, being a view that you're seeing from that Slaughterhouse 5 mountainscape.
Yeah.
But anyway, I forgot what I was going
to
say.
So circling back to the Veldt, I mean, do we feel like the Veldt, this like horror landscape, is this the ultimate performance? Like, is this the performative art of this psyche of these children? Does that terrify us?
Yeah. Yes, and I think it's a lack of... So without the like fully developed frontal cortex, right, they don't have the consequence aspect of it. So there's not really like an understanding of what happens next. But I
that's
think
why children are so useful in horror, right?
Oh
so
my God. They're wonderful. And I feel like I've made it out to sound like I like my child is my children are probably the most delightful people that I know because they're so authentic.
Right.
they're only just now learning the performative nature of existence, right? And starting to do little poses for cameras and stuff
ego
that you're
things.
Like
little memes.
Oh, uh-huh.
Me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You're like, oh, snap. There you are.
There you are.
There you are.
Cool it.
But, yeah, I think, so the other thing, too, I think that the Veldt and the house, the Veldt illustrates that we live under now is the idea that something else is watching. So, like, the house is alive. And when he goes to turn it off, it has feelings about that. Or at least I read it that way, that the lions are an extension of the house.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
right.
So that's really fascinating because if we look allegorically, like if the house itself is representative of maybe the cultural forces that, and by cultural forces, I really mean like the capitalist forces, which, you know, inform the construction of our culture.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. like the investment of capital to continue to see itself persist. Mm-hmm. Right. Is that not just like another word for hegemony? Right. Like,
is that how that's pronounced? Yeah. I feel like I've only ever read it and I have been reading it wrong in my brain this whole time.
I have no idea.
Oh my gosh. We do this all the time. We come across a word and it's like, this is the first time
heard it out loud.
I mean, I did a lot of talking about hegemony.
I'm kind of uncomfortable how you're both looking at me right now.
we need to do the Pee-wee's Playhouse thing with the word of the day.
Yeah.
Hegemony.
That's the first time anybody's ever cheered for that word. I think like, you know, again, coming back to this notion of like the house wants to persist.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. The structure wants to persist at the expense of the people it's supposed to serve.
Right?
And like, not to sound like, you know, the Unabomber here, right? But they built the system and now the system controls them. Like, that's
again,
a little bit of a Frankenstein's monster thing too.
Mr. Marxist over here is like revolution is coming. Yes.
Yes. Well, okay. So you asked, sorry, this was in a different episode. You asked about, the relationship, like the purpose that fiction and horror and genre serves. And I think that's exactly the purpose that it serves, is to show you a future that you may not realize is coming for you, or at least plant it in your head. So that I, having read this when I was 14, watch my daughter on her iPad and I'm like, fucking Veldt, right? Like, that's in my, but it is like woven into my personality.
That
like I am like, we must course correct, like, or I will be eaten by lions, like, but that's a real thing. Puts that fear there.
To borrow a term from Darko Suvin, I think it's cognitive mapping, right?
Go.
That's the term.
There you go.
The idea of trying to understand who we are and how we exist in this much broader cultural framework, right? And how is the framework shaping who we are? Can we ultimately reframe that framework? Can we revolutionize it? Can we, you know, kind of approach it? Can we change it? Does seeing this story played out across a man's skin in the Illustrated Man, does this help us anticipate that future and perhaps take action to ensure that these nightmares never come to pass? I don't know.
Who knows?
I mean,
I worry.
We'll find out.
But I think it has to, and if it's going to, it's only going to happen this way. So you talk about like revolution, right? And I think I'm going to totally butcher this, so I'm so sorry. I think it's Toni Morrison who said something along the lines of like, you have to basically be bold enough to stand at the very edge and declare it center, and wait for everyone to catch up to you.
Yeah.
And you have to like firmly say, no, this is center. And you have to believe it so wholeheartedly that other people are like, oh shit, that's the center. And then they kind of like walk over to join you. Mm. But that it's like this kind of lonely, isolating space. But I think that works like this do that. They move that needle so that the rest of us catch up.
Right.
And then it shifts our scope on like how we look at things. And I think we're in a moment of that now. Like that's, the whole world is shifting so quickly.
I agree.
Because there's this same hunger that you're experiencing. Yep. That there's a lot of fear, but there's a lot of hunger that says like something has to change because the path that we are on is one that we're not happy with. That's why we have so many dystopias. Right. People are like, what, like...
Yeah, we didn't talk about this necessarily in your episode, but I think like this is a conversation kind of adjacent to a conversation maybe started in your episode. You know, like the issue of dystopia. You know, and because this is very dystopic, right?
Yes.
You know, again, what does dystopia kind of serve to us? Especially to those of us who feel like we're already living in a dystopia.
Right. It's like, man, one thing at a time, please.
Yeah.
Quit piling darkness onto me.
It's everything all the time. That's fine. It's fine. There is no relief. No. Yeah. The future's a dark and dreary place. I'm just kidding.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why I continue to look at fiction and look at speculative fiction, especially like to find the utopia. Mm-hmm. Like, where is the utopian value in the literature that we encounter?
Right.
Even in dystopian, you know, narratives or something like this, like, what is the utopian hope? Is there a utopian hope that we can glean from this?
Yeah.
And, you know, is there something in this fiction that maybe empowers us to make decisions conscientiously as human beings to create a more hospitable future?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well said.
Of course, my mind just goes to, we've had this very in-depth discussion about this story and the real life illustrated man sitting there going, you know, it'd be cool. Lions, bro. That'd be cool right here.
We end on a joke.
We have to end on a joke, folks. It's, you know,
we have to. That was the utopia.
I mean, the end. That's the end. That's the end.
I'm creating the podcast, it gave me options. It didn't tell me, you know, you can write, do a book, you know, review kind of podcast. The options it gave me, the most applicable one that I could find was comedy.
You've come back to like the whole, is it the context shapes the content that you're creating? Like you are writing to this genre, whether you mean to or not, like you end up constrained. It's the lights. It's the lights from the Unabomber. It's the stuff lights. You built the light and now it controls you.
The idea that the episode is structured like a Greek comedy. Yes. Which is just to say, like, there's a happy ending.
That's the
happy ending, perhaps if there is a happy ending to this episode, it's that we're all in a room together and we can appreciate
Nobody got eaten by a lion.
Okay, but to be fair, she does offer him tea at the end. So, like, that's kind of a nice note. Like, Wendy's like,
hospitable.
Would you like some tea? And then the illustrated man's like, I'm going to roll over. And we move on to the next story, which is people floating through space aimlessly toward death. So, you know. Yeah. Y'all aren't going to invite me back. Y'all going to be like, she's dreary. I'm not even like trying to be. Like, actually, really, I'm like super nice in real life, I promise.
No, we are totally going to invite you back. We really, really had fun with this today.
Well, I've pressured you on the air. Now you have to.
I mean, we were going to invite you back anyway.
Yeah, my brain is already.
That's right. Manifest the future you want.
Yeah, my brain is already like, this is the most philosophical I think we've gotten on
I'm
the show.
I'm so sorry.
And I'm here. No, I'm like, that's what I signed up for. Like, I'm always the one who's like philosophy. And Jeremy's like, remember that pop culture reference? I'm like, God damn it.
We've got a balance, man. See, we have a balance.
I was going to say, him get the pop culture references. Yeah. So, there is kind of a balance there.
We've had a great time today. Thank you, Kaylee, so much for joining us, or Kay.
Thank you for having me. And, in both variations of myself. They're the same. Kay's just a nickname, so you guys can call. I'll know me by that, too.
Kay.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We've really enjoyed the talk today, and we'll see you guys next time.